On the afternoon of April 11, 2021, a routine traffic stop on a quiet street in Brooklyn Center, Minnesota, began like thousands of others across the state. Officers approached a white sedan, checked paperwork, and tried to sort out a warrant tied to the driver, 20-year-old Daunte Wright. Nothing about those first few minutes looked unusual. Then the tone shifted. Wright pulled away from the door. Commands overlapped. One officer stepped forward with what she believed was her taser. The weapon in her hand was not a taser. A single shot echoed through the car. Wright drove off, wounded, and crashed moments later. The first radio call went out less than a minute after the encounter began. Within the hour, the story reached living rooms across the country, raising the same urgent question heard after so many traffic stops turned deadly. What happened in those seconds, and why did it end with a young man losing his life? Chapter 1. The Stop. The afternoon of April 11, 2021, was calm in Brooklyn Center. The sky held a soft gray light. Traffic moved slowly along suburban streets lined with modest houses, trimmed lawns, and early spring trees that had not yet filled with leaves. People were driving home from errands, grocery stores, or weekend visits. Nothing suggested that the next few minutes would become the center of national news. At about 2 p.m., a white Buick SUV moved along Orchard Avenue. Inside sat 20-year-old Daunte Wright, wearing a light hooded sweatshirt, driving with his girlfriend in the passenger seat. They were heading to a car wash. The air inside the car felt ordinary. The plans for the day had nothing to do with trouble. Then patrol officers noticed expired registration tags. They also saw an air freshener hanging from the rearview mirror, an issue that had been used as a stopping point in past traffic encounters across the state. The officers pulled behind the car and activated their lights. Wright slowed and made a right turn. He rolled forward and stopped. The cruiser pulled in behind him. Dash cameras captured the scene. Body cameras clicked on as officers stepped out and approached on both sides of the vehicle. Their tone was calm. They asked for identification. Wright handed over a name and birth date. Nothing in his voice suggested tension. The officer at the driver's side door explained the issue about the tags. Wright nodded and looked straight ahead. He did not raise his voice. The passenger stayed quiet, hands visible. Inside the squad car, officers ran Wright's information through the database. A hit returned. There was an outstanding warrant related to a missed court date for a previous weapons case. The officers had to confirm whether the warrant was active and what it required them to do. One officer signaled to the others that they would need to take Wright into custody. This was standard procedure. They walked back to the car. When the officers reached the driver's door again, they asked Wright to step out. He opened the door and stepped onto the pavement. His hands rested near his waistband. The officers told him they needed him to turn around. Wright hesitated, then slowly placed his hands behind his back. One officer began placing metal cuffs around his wrists. The passenger looked out the open door, startled, but did not interfere. Another officer watched closely, keeping a safe stance near the front of the car. For a moment, everything remained steady. The scene felt controlled. The officers had arrested people before under similar circumstances. Wright had been stopped by police before. The tension in the air rose only slightly. Then Wright shifted his weight. He looked toward the open door of his car. There was a split-second decision. He pulled forward, twisting out of the officer's grip. The cuffs had not fully locked around his wrists. He reached the driver's seat. The officer holding him shouted for him to stop. The scene changed fast. Wright's foot went inside the car. The officer grabbed his arm. Another officer stepped forward to assist. Commands overlapped. The passenger froze, her hands raised. The officers tried to keep Wright from closing the door. They repeated the same instruction, "Stop, don't move." Wright pulled again toward the seat. It was a struggle in a tight space. The body camera captured frantic hands and shifting elbows. Officer Kim Potter stepped in from the right side of the frame. She had spent more than 20 years on the force. She carried her handgun on her right side and her taser on her left. Protocols required the taser to be holstered in a way that forced the officer to draw it with the non-dominant hand. Training manuals stressed the importance of muscle memory. Officers repeated the motions many times to prevent confusion in high-pressure moments. Potter moved close as the struggle intensified. She shouted a warning. Her voice was sharp. She said "taser" several times. The officers near Wright did not pull back. They continued trying to restrain him. Potter raised her right hand. The weapon in that hand was a Glock handgun. The body camera footage showed the black frame. She aimed and fired one shot. The sound of the discharge cut through the shouting. Wright gasped. He pulled forward, slammed the door, and hit the accelerator. The car lurched ahead. Officers stepped back to avoid being struck. The vehicle sped down the street. Potter's voice filled the audio. She said she had grabbed the wrong weapon. Her voice broke. She repeated the same words, shocked at what had just happened. The officers ran back to their squad car. They radioed the situation, calling out that Wright had been shot and had fled the scene. Another unit responded. The dispatcher repeated the urgency. Sirens echoed down the street as multiple cars accelerated toward the area where Wright's vehicle had gone. A few blocks away, the Buick collided with another car. Smoke rose from the front of the vehicle. Residents rushed outside, hearing the crash. Witnesses called 911 and described a young man slumped in the driver's seat. The passenger was crying and trying to get him to respond. First responders broke the window and pulled the door open. They called for medical assistance and tried to assess the wound. They attempted life-saving measures at the scene. Wright showed no signs of recovery. He died at the site of the crash, minutes after the shot was fired. The officers at the original stop remained on scene to secure the area and prepare for investigators. They placed yellow tape around the vehicle's final position and documented skid marks on the street. The passenger sat on the curb, wrapped in a blanket, shaking, still trying to make sense of what had happened. Detectives spoke to her gently and gathered her statement. By late afternoon, the Minnesota Bureau of Criminal Apprehension arrived. They took control of the investigation. This was standard protocol whenever an officer fired a weapon resulting in death. Their agents documented the scene, collected physical evidence, and secured body camera footage. One team worked at the traffic stop location. Another worked at the crash site. They photographed every angle, marking bullet trajectory, vehicle position, and debris patterns. The news began spreading locally within the first hour. A few residents recorded the aftermath and posted short clips online. Families nearby called friends and relatives, explaining that police had shot someone during a traffic stop. Tension grew. Officers recognized the need for clear public information. The city scheduled an evening press conference. At the podium, city officials confirmed a fatal shooting involving an officer. They explained that footage existed and would be reviewed by state investigators. They did not release the officer's name that night. They did not provide details about the warrant or the struggle, but acknowledged that the community would have questions. They promised transparency. Crowds started gathering near the site. Some people held signs. Others lit candles on the sidewalk. Traffic backed up as more residents arrived. The scene became emotional, tense, and heavy. Police set up barriers to keep the road open, but the crowd continued to grow. Meanwhile, inside the police station, officers reviewed their own body camera footage. Supervisors placed Potter on administrative leave, which was standard in any deadly force case. They prepared to meet with investigators from the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. The department's leadership understood that the case would draw immediate attention because of the national climate surrounding policing. As evening fell, the lights around the neighborhood dimmed. Residents stood in small groups, talking quietly or crying softly. A few held their phones and tried to explain what they had heard. Wright's family members received calls. They arrived near the scene and sought answers. Officers tried to keep the area secure, but emotions ran high. Throughout the night, the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension continued their work. They collected Potter's weapon for analysis. They retrieved her taser to compare weight, grip, and holster orientation. They interviewed officers who had been at the scene. They documented Potter's immediate reaction, captured on camera. The city released a brief written statement acknowledging the gravity of the event and asking residents to remain peaceful while the investigation moved forward. Local reporters gathered at the perimeter, speaking with neighbors who described what they had seen after the crash. Each person's recollection added small details to the wider picture. By the next morning, national outlets began reporting the story. Headlines framed it as a traffic stop that turned fatal, raising questions about training, split-second decisions, and deadly outcomes. The footage had not yet been released publicly, but officials soon realized that withholding it would only deepen suspicion. The press conference later that day included an acknowledgement by the police chief that Potter had fired one shot and had stated immediately afterward that she believed she had drawn her taser. The chief called it an accidental discharge. Reporters pressed for clarity. They asked how a trained officer could confuse the two weapons. They asked why the stop escalated. They asked what policies govern the use of force in such situations. The footage was shown to the media. The public reaction was swift. Many viewers saw the warning shouts and heard Potter call out the word taser before firing. They also saw the moment Wright was struck. For some, this confirmed the possibility of weapon confusion. For others, it reinforced concerns about traffic stop tactics and use of force decisions. Throughout the day, people gathered outside the police department. Some demanded accountability. Others demanded answers. The city announced that the police chief and the officer were both facing internal review. Investigators continued interviewing witnesses, including those who had arrived at the crash site. Autopsy results were requested. Wright's family met with community leaders. By the end of the second day, the case had expanded beyond a local investigation. Questions grew louder. Was this preventable? What training protocols were in place? Why did the struggle escalate so quickly? What did the footage reveal about officer decision-making in the heat of the moment? Each question added pressure to the investigation. The Bureau of Criminal Apprehension prepared to release its preliminary findings to the county attorney, who would determine whether criminal charges were warranted. The events at the traffic stop were now under microscopic scrutiny. Behind the scenes, investigators worked through the timeline second by second. They matched radio logs to body camera footage. They examined holster placement and force guidelines. They compared Potter's actions to department policies. They studied the physical evidence from the car and the scene. They interviewed specialists about taser confusion incidents recorded in other states. While they built their case, the community waited for answers. Some residents feared unrest. Others prepared for peaceful gatherings. Many simply mourned the loss of a young life. In the hours after the shooting, the city had moved from calm routine to national focus. A standard traffic stop, something that happens countless times a day, had ended in tragedy. The question that now stood at the center of the investigation was simple but heavy. How did a traffic encounter lasting only minutes end with a fatal shot? That question shaped everything that followed. The chapter closes on the threshold of the investigation's deeper work, with the timeline established and the stakes clear. A young man was dead. An officer said she had made a deadly mistake. The state's top investigators were now tasked with determining exactly what happened and why. Chapter 2, Profiles and Proof. In the days after the shooting, the story of Daunte Wright moved from a brief headline into a fuller picture of a young man's life. At first, he appeared in the news only as a name, an age, and a short description. Reporters said he was 20 years old, a black man, stopped for expired tags and wanted on a warrant. That frame did not say much about who he was before the traffic stop. His family began to fill in the gaps. They shared photos of Wright holding his young son, smiling at birthdays, slouched on couches with friends, and dressed up for family gatherings. His mother described him as a playful kid who loved to joke around. She said he called her from the traffic stop that day, nervous, asking what he should do. Wright had not lived a perfect life, but his family insisted that he was more than a record or a warrant. To them, he was a son, a father, a brother, and a young man trying to find his footing. Wright had not yet settled into a steady career. Like many 20-year-olds, he bounced between jobs, temporary work, and plans that did not always land. There had been earlier contact with police, including a weapons-related case that led to the warrant at the center of the stop. Supporters pointed out that none of this changed the fact that the traffic stop began over registration tags and ended with a single shot. They asked whether his entire life should be judged only through legal paperwork. As his name spread across television and radio, people who knew Wright spoke to reporters. They described him as funny, sometimes immature, but also caring. Some remembered him as the kid who would check in on friends when they were having a hard time. Others mentioned that he was trying to better his situation and provide for his child. Their comments did not erase the legal issues on his record, but placed them in a broader frame of a young adult still in the middle of his story. On the other side of the case stood Officer Kim Potter. She had joined the Brooklyn Center Police Department in the mid-1990s. Over more than two decades, she worked as a patrol officer, field training officer, and union leader. Colleagues described her as steady and professional. She had no widely reported record of prior shootings. Her career had included the routine mix of traffic stops, calls for service, and incidents that shape daily patrol work. Potter's training history included certification on both firearms and conducted energy devices, commonly known as tasers. Department policy placed her handgun on her dominant right side and her taser on her left in a cross-draw holster. This setup was designed to reduce the risk of confusion under stress. Officers drilled the difference during training. They practiced drawing each device, feeling the contrast in grip, weight, and position. After the shooting, investigators gathered Potter's training records, performance reviews, and prior use of force history. They needed to understand not only what happened on April 11, but also how her background might shed light on her decision-making in that moment. They noted that taser deployments had become common tools for officers dealing with resistant subjects. The idea was to use a less lethal option when possible. The question in this case was whether the officer had truly believed she was reaching for that option when she drew her handgun. The Minnesota Bureau of Criminal Apprehension took the lead on these questions. Their agents interviewed officers who had worked alongside Potter. They asked about her habits, her approach to stressful calls, and her handling of previous tense situations. They also requested records on department taser training, including how often officers were required to recertify and under what scenarios. At the same time, investigators focused on the physical evidence. They retrieved Potter's handgun and taser for comparison. The handgun, a standard-issue semi-automatic pistol, had a clear weight and recoil pattern that officers were used to. The taser, by contrast, had a different color and a distinct grip. It also weighed less. Agents documented both devices, weighing them, photographing them, and recording their condition. They checked which side of the duty belt each weapon had been holstered on at the time of the stop. The body camera footage became a central piece of the investigation. Analysts slowed it down frame by frame. They noted the way Potter moved into position, her hand placement, and the angle at which she drew her weapon. They listened closely to her words and tone. She shouted, "Taser," three times. Then the shot fired. Immediately afterward, she said that she had grabbed the wrong gun. To investigators, that sequence was critical. It suggested her state of mind in those seconds. The Bureau also examined the timeline from the first activation of the squad car's lights to the final crash. They matched radio transmissions with camera footage. They tracked the exact moment the warrant hit came back. They traced each officer's position around the vehicle and their specific actions as the situation escalated. This work allowed them to build a detailed reconstruction of the encounter. An autopsy on Wright's body confirmed that he died from a single gunshot wound to the chest. The report listed the manner of death as homicide, a standard medical term indicating that another person caused the death. It did not by itself decide whether a crime had been committed. That decision would fall to prosecutors, who had to weigh evidence of intent, recklessness, or negligence under Minnesota law. Investigators also looked at the environment. They examined the street layout, the distance between the initial stop and the crash site, and the lighting conditions. They noted that the incident happened in broad daylight. Visibility was clear, weather was not a factor. There were no reports of an external threat at the scene, aside from the struggle between Wright and the officers at the door. Interviews with Wright's passenger provided another view of the moment. She described the traffic stop, the officer's request for Wright to step out, and the attempt to handcuff him. She recalled the sudden shift when Wright tried to get back into the car. She remembered the shot and the chaos that followed. The investigators compared her statement with the body camera footage to see where details aligned and where memory diverged under stress. Experts on police use of force and conducted energy weapons were consulted. They explained the concept of slip and capture, a theory where, under sudden stress, a trained action can override an intended action. In that theory, the brain intends to perform one movement but defaults to a more dominant habit. In this case, Potter's dominant hand draw of the handgun could have overridden her intention to draw the taser with her non-dominant hand. Supporters of this explanation argued that the footage and her immediate reaction supported a mistake. Critics argued that whatever the mechanism, officers carried the responsibility to avoid such deadly errors. These expert views did not decide the case, but they helped prosecutors understand how weapon confusion had been documented in other incidents around the country. There had been a small number of cases over the years where officers said they mistakenly fired a handgun instead of a taser. Investigators reviewed some of these cases to see how agencies and courts had treated them. Each case had its own facts, but together they showed that mistakes of this type, while rare, were not entirely unheard of. While technical details occupied investigators and prosecutors, the community focused on a simpler narrative. Wright had been stopped for equipment violations and ended up dead. Many residents saw this as part of a broader pattern of black drivers facing disproportionate attention and risk during traffic stops. Advocates pointed to data showing racial disparities in stops, searches, and use of force across the United States. The case became another example in a long-running discussion about race and policing. At vigils, speakers read out Wright's name alongside other names that had become widely known in similar contexts. They talked about the fear many black drivers felt when they saw police lights in the rearview mirror. Parents described teaching their children how to act during stops, to keep hands visible and voices calm, in the hope of avoiding escalation. The fact that the Brooklyn Center incident occurred not long after other high-profile cases in Minnesota added to the tension. Inside the legal system, the focus was narrower. Prosecutors needed to decide what charges, if any, would reflect the evidence. They considered statutes relating to manslaughter and criminal negligence. Second-degree manslaughter in Minnesota involves creating an unreasonable risk and consciously taking chances of causing death or great bodily harm. Third-degree manslaughter and negligent homicide statutes were also reviewed. The key question was which charge, if supported, best matched an officer who claimed to have fired the wrong weapon. The process of reaching a charging decision involved careful review of the Bureau's investigative file. Prosecutors studied the footage, autopsy, weapon comparisons, and statements. They looked at training documents and department policies to see how clearly the taser and handgun were supposed to be distinguished. They considered whether Potter's behavior fit within or outside those guidelines. At the same time, the Brooklyn Center Police Department carried out its own administrative review. They examined whether any policies were violated during the stop. They looked at the decision to attempt an arrest at the vehicle, the tactics used to restrain Wright, and the coordination between officers at the scene. Administrative outcomes could include discipline, retraining, or termination, separate from any criminal case. The union representing officers monitored each step closely. They argued that officers operate in dangerous and unpredictable conditions, making rapid decisions under stress. They warned against rushing to judgment before the full investigative picture was clear. Civil rights advocates countered that the pattern of deadly outcomes in routine stops demanded urgent scrutiny and reform. Meanwhile, the Wright family retained legal representation and began preparing potential civil claims. Their attorneys called the shooting preventable and pointed to the fact that the encounter began over tags and a warrant related to earlier conduct, not an active violent crime in progress. They argued that alternative tactics, such as disengaging and re-arresting later, could have reduced the risk. These claims would be pursued in separate civil proceedings. The investigation also looked at the role of supervision. Who was in charge at the scene? What guidance did that person give during the stop and in the moments before the shot? Did department policy require a different approach with multiple officers present? Supervisors were interviewed about their expectations and how those expectations were conveyed during roll call briefings and training sessions. The more investigators dug, the more the case became about systems as well as individuals. Training, equipment design, policy language, and culture all intersected in those few seconds at the driver's door. Was this only about one officer's error, or was it the visible result of deeper weaknesses in how the department handled traffic enforcement and use of force training? While those questions circulated in official meeting rooms, the community saw simpler images. A grieving mother speaking at a microphone, a small child who would grow up without his father, protest signs outside the police station, officers in riot gear standing behind barricades, curfews announced over emergency channels as officials tried to prevent property damage and keep people safe. For investigators, every piece of proof had to be documented in calm, clinical detail. For residents, every day that passed without accountability felt heavy. These different experiences unfolded at the same time. By the time the Bureau wrapped up its initial report, they had assembled a layered record. There was the human story of Daunte Wright and his family. There was the professional story of Kim Potter, her years on the force, and her training. There was the technical story of weapon design, holster placement, and stress responses. And there was the legal story of statutes, standards, and possible charges. All of it pointed toward a decision point that now rested with prosecutors. The question had sharpened. Given the evidence and the law, what should be done about an officer who said she had meant to fire a taser, but instead fired a single deadly shot? The answer to that question would define the next phase of the case. It would also signal to the community and to departments far beyond Brooklyn Center how the justice system viewed responsibility when deadly mistakes occurred during routine police work. As the second chapter of this story closed, the facts collected by investigators stood ready on desks and screens. Wright's life had been examined in detail. Potter's record and actions had been scrutinized. The physical and digital evidence had been broken down and rebuilt into a clear timeline. The next step was no longer about gathering facts. It was about deciding what those facts meant under the law and what accountability, if any, would look like. Chapter 3, Decision, Trial, and Aftermath. As prosecutors reviewed the investigative file, they understood that the next step carried national weight. The death of Daunte Wright had already prompted large crowds outside the Brooklyn Center Police Department. News outlets waited for an update. Community members wanted to know whether the legal system would treat the shooting as a tragic mistake, a criminal act, or something in between. Prosecutors had to examine the evidence by the book, separate emotion from law, and decide whether charges were supported by the facts. In Minnesota, several statutes could apply to fatal police encounters, but one stood out in this case. Second-degree manslaughter covers situations where a person acts with culpable negligence, creating an unreasonable risk and consciously taking chances of causing death or great bodily harm. Prosecutors asked themselves whether drawing a handgun instead of a taser met that standard. They looked again at Potter's actions, her commands, her weapon draw, and her immediate reaction. They studied whether she should have recognized the difference between the two weapons. They evaluated the risk created by firing into a moving vehicle when other officers were close by. Within days, they announced the decision. Officer Kim Potter was charged with second-degree manslaughter. The announcement was brief but direct. Prosecutors said the evidence supported the charge and that law enforcement officers, like all members of the public, were accountable to the law. They emphasized that the justice system must review every case based on facts, not assumptions. The charges intensified the public response. Crowds outside the police station grew larger. Signs and candles lined the sidewalks. People from nearby neighborhoods, other Minnesota cities, and even out of state gathered to call for justice. Some came to mourn. Others came to protest police practices they believed placed black residents at higher risk during traffic stops. Many spoke of exhaustion from repeated high-profile cases in the region. City leaders called for calm and urged people not to damage property or confront officers. But the emotions stirring through the community were strong. Curfews were put in place for several nights. The National Guard assisted local police to prevent unrest from escalating. The city's mayor held press conferences, explaining that the process was moving forward and that more information would be made public as the case advanced. Inside the Brooklyn Center Police Department, the shooting led to swift internal changes. The police chief announced his resignation. Another senior leader stepped down as well. Officers were reassigned. Command structures shifted. The department pledged to examine traffic stop policies, especially those involving lower-level equipment violations. City council members introduced proposals to overhaul how such stops were handled, considering whether additional civilian staff or specialized teams could address non-dangerous violations without armed officers. Potter was arrested and booked. She was later released on bond. Her attorney stated that she had acted under immense pressure and had never intended harm. They described her as devastated and distraught. They said she had dedicated more than 20 years to her work and had never before fired her weapon at a person. They insisted that she had believed she was reaching for her taser. The case then moved into the next phase, pre-trial hearings. During these sessions, the judge reviewed the evidence, addressed motions from both sides, and set ground rules for the trial. The defense requested certain limits on how prosecutors could frame the struggle at the vehicle. Prosecutors sought to include context on training, holster placement, and the significance of Potter drawing with her dominant hand. The trial date was set. Security preparations were extensive. The courthouse established restricted areas. Nearby streets were prepared for possible protests. Reporters received guidance on courtroom access and procedures. When jury selection began, the court screened potential jurors for bias. They were asked whether they could remain neutral despite widespread media coverage. Many had seen the footage. Many had heard commentary from both supporters and critics. Some expressed that the case made them uncomfortable, but believed they could judge the evidence fairly. Others said the topic was too emotional or too close to home. The court dismissed those who could not promise impartiality. The final jury reflected a cross-section of residents. They understood the gravity of the case. They were instructed to decide the matter solely based on the evidence presented in court, not on public reaction or external views about policing. The trial opened with each side presenting its narrative. Prosecutors stated that Potter acted with culpable negligence. They argued that her failure to distinguish between her handgun and taser showed a disregard for the risk to Wright's life. They said the video reflected clear errors in judgment, including standing too close during the attempted arrest and drawing the wrong weapon under stress. They reminded jurors that police officers are trained repeatedly to avoid exactly that scenario. The defense countered by saying the shooting was a tragic accident. They emphasized Potter's years of service, her training, and her emotional breakdown after realizing what had happened. They told jurors that she had shouted "taser" 3 times, showing her intention to use a less lethal device. They argued that accidents, while devastating, are not crimes unless they meet the legal threshold for recklessness or negligence. They insisted that Potter had acted in good faith, trying to protect other officers as Wright attempted to flee. Prosecutors presented witnesses from the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. They explained the timeline and displayed footage frame by frame. They pointed out the difference between the yellow taser and the black handgun. They showed the weight differences between the devices. They explained where each weapon had been holstered on Potter's duty belt. They described the taser as lighter, bulkier, and designed to be drawn with the non-dominant hand. They noted that the handgun had a heavier metal frame and a more rigid grip. Jurors held the unloaded weapons under supervision to feel the contrast. Medical experts testified that Wright died from a single gunshot wound to the chest. The autopsy report was read aloud in plain terms. Prosecutors did not focus on past legal issues in Wright's life, consistent with court guidelines that limited such information. Instead, they concentrated on the actions taken during the stop and whether those actions created unreasonable risks. The defense brought in experts on stress responses. These experts testified about slip and capture, a concept suggesting that under intense stress, the brain may revert to a dominant habit. They said that in fast-moving encounters, even trained officers can mistakenly execute the wrong motor program. They argued that Potter's reflex to draw with her right hand was consistent with this theory. The defense also highlighted the chaos of the struggle. They described the tight space near the driver's door, the sudden movement when Wright twisted away, and the officer's concern that Wright might drive off with one officer partially inside the vehicle. They argued that Potter's intention was to stop Wright from fleeing in a way that could harm others. Throughout the trial, Potter sat at the defense table, often looking down. When footage played showing her immediate reaction after the shot, she appeared emotional. Jurors watched her response closely. Some took notes. Others kept their eyes fixed on the screen. When it was their turn, Wright's family members listened from the gallery. They remained composed, but visibly strained. Their presence reminded the courtroom that the case was not only about statutes and procedures, but also about the loss of a human life. After both sides finished presenting evidence, the judge instructed the jury on the legal standards. The jurors then entered deliberation. They requested playback of footage. They asked questions about the definitions of negligence and culpable risk. They spent hours reviewing testimony. Eventually, they returned to the courtroom with a verdict. The judge read the decision aloud. The jury found Potter guilty of second-degree manslaughter. Some jurors looked down, others stared ahead. The room remained silent, except for the voice delivering the result. Potter's shoulders lowered as she absorbed the verdict. Wright's family held each other tightly. The judge ordered that Potter be taken into custody pending sentencing. The sentencing hearing occurred weeks later. Prosecutors argued that the seriousness of the harm demanded accountability. They acknowledged that Potter had not acted with intent to kill, but insisted that her negligence carried severe consequences. The defense spoke of her years of service, her remorse, and the fact that she had no prior disciplinary history. They asked for leniency. Wright's mother addressed the court. She spoke about her son's life, his struggles, and his potential. She described the pain of losing him and the weight carried every day by his absence. She said her family wanted justice, not vengeance, and hoped that the sentence would reflect the value of her son's life. Potter also spoke. She said she was sorry. Her voice shook. She said she never intended harm and wished she could take back the moment. She said she would live with the outcome for the rest of her life. The judge delivered the sentence, a term of imprisonment following the state's guidelines for second-degree manslaughter. The judge explained that the sentence reflected both accountability and recognition of the lack of intent. It was meant to balance justice with fairness under the law. After the sentencing, reactions varied. Supporters of Wright's family said the verdict affirmed that police officers must be held accountable when their actions cause death, even if they claim it was accidental. Some believed the sentence was too light. Others argued that Potter's mistake did not deserve prison time. In Minnesota and beyond, debates continued about policing, traffic stops, training, racial disparities, and the boundaries of lawful force. Policy discussions gained momentum. The city and state reviewed traffic stop practices. Legislators introduced proposals to limit stops for minor equipment violations. Activists pushed for broader reforms, including changes to use of force laws and increased oversight of police departments. Experts debated whether redesigning tasers or adjusting holster placement could reduce the risk of weapon confusion. Wright's family pursued civil claims. These cases focused on whether the city or department bore responsibility for training, policy design, or supervision. Civil settlements in similar incidents around the country had varied widely. These proceedings would move forward independently of the criminal case. The broader impact of the shooting continued to unfold. For many residents, the incident underscored the fragile relationship between communities and police. Even after the verdict, many felt that deeper systemic issues remained unresolved. Others saw the case as a painful but necessary reminder that accountability must apply to everyone, including officers. For the Brooklyn Center Police Department, the shooting became a turning point. Training programs were reevaluated, supervisors monitored weapon placement practices more closely. Officers went through additional sessions on taser handgun differentiation. New debates emerged about whether lower-level stops should involve armed officers or whether alternative approaches could reduce risk for everyone involved. In the community, memorials to Wright stayed in place for months. People brought flowers, signs, and photographs. His name appeared on murals and in speeches. His family continued speaking publicly about the need for reform. They emphasized that their son's memory should push the city to improve how it approached public safety. For Potter, the case closed a long law enforcement career. Her actions would be judged for years in academic studies, police training seminars, and public discussions about weapon confusion. In those conversations, the facts established in the investigation and trial would be examined from many angles. The central question remained the same: how something meant to be a routine stop turned into a fatal event. As the final chapter of this case settled, the story left behind hard truths and difficult lessons. It showed how small decisions in high-pressure moments can change the course of lives. It revealed the limits of training and the weight of responsibility placed on officers. It highlighted the vulnerabilities felt by many drivers, particularly Black residents, during police encounters. And it showed how communities struggle to rebuild trust after violent outcomes, even when the justice system delivers a verdict. The death of Daunte Wright did not resolve national debates about policing, accountability, or race, but it did underscore the urgency of those conversations. It reminded people that traffic stops, something that happens thousands of times a day, can carry enormous stakes. And it left a lasting question that still echoes in policy meetings, courtrooms, and living rooms. How can a system built to protect the public ensure that routine encounters do not turn deadly? That question remains open, guiding future reforms and shaping the search for a safer path forward.